Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Matt Cochran. Matt is a self-taught investor and got his start on Motley Fool message boards, ended up writing for them for a while, covered payments. He's just an all-around good guy, and I enjoy talking to him. So figured invite him on the show, see if he says yes. He said yes. I enjoyed the conversation. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence.
Matt Cochran, joining the Business Brew. Matt, nice to have you. It has been very fun getting to know you over the years, and I felt like this was a great time to catch up and chat. How's everything going?
Everything's going great, Bill. Thanks so much for having me. And yes, the feeling is mutual. I consider you a good friend, and I always enjoy chatting with you.
We were chatting Google before we got on the podcast, and I don't know how to look at anything other than to say that's a hell of a business. And if people are going to sell it on deceleration or macroeconomic weakness, that's not a game that I know how to play well.
No. And this probably is a good segue into our conversation. But like, Alphabet's one of those businesses where, like, I don't think you have to play that game well to make money or even like probably beat the market just holding a great company like that.
So when you say that, like, obviously, you know, entry price matters, right? And I think that if the last 20 months have taught anybody anything, hopefully it's that valuation does matter eventually. I do wonder how much we're taking that lesson. I don't know. There's a lot of dunking on things right now on social media, and I'm not sure how much of it's warranted, and I'm not sure how much of it is. I think there's probably a little bit of truth and a little bit of shot and fraud. But how do you generally invest, and kind of where was your philosophy started, for lack of a better term? Like, where did you learn and where did you develop your philosophy?
Well, I think you mostly know the answer to this. But
I do, but my listeners may not.
That's fine. There's probably two primary origins to like my investing philosophy, which if you really wanted to boil it down to like two principles, I think you could say buy stocks with wide economic moats and hold for the long term, and like hashtag never sell and all that. Like I'm mostly on hashtag never sell's team. But like the genesis for my investment philosophy came from one, it was Peter Lynch's books, like Beating the Street and One Up on Wall Street, like just amazing books, and The Motley Fool. So like those two, like those two books, and then learning at The Motley Fool, and a lot of that was just on their discussion boards, which back in the day were incredibly robust and incredibly helpful, and more like think of all the good stuff on FinTwit without like with 80% less negative stuff was probably like how you could have the Motley Fool discussion boards. And like back in the day, they were just great. And there were some wonderfully patient investors on those boards when like I was a new investor and started to ask like annoying, tedious questions, and they would just always help me out. Like, I mean, I remember like talking about free cash flow and asking this guy, well, how do you figure out that? Well, you know, like, operation cash flow minus CapEx. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? Like, how do you, when you look at this 10Q, like how do you get that from there? And just like to almost walk me like line through, you know, line by line through a 10Q for stuff like that. And those boards, I feel like are a lot where I grew up.
That's I guess that would be a little bit nicer place, right? Because they've got moderators, and I'm sure that it's a little bit more of a probably a polite community necessary. And I think also, and I don't know what I'm talking about here, but I suspect that it's a little bit more of a common ground where people are approaching problems from. Whereas like FinTwit, you bump into a whole bunch of different people thinking a whole bunch of different ways, and sometimes people get talking past each other. I wonder if there's a more common discussion going on in a more like-minded community.
Yeah, I would say it's more common and more like-minded. I you know, not perfectly homogenous community, but it was by and large, it was definitely politer than Twitter can be. You can't have a thin skin on Twitter, right? Like, you just have to, if you're going to engage on Twitter, a lot of it is just going to be like, well, you know, you just need to have a thick skin and not get distracted by all the noise, because it's almost like drinking from a fire hose. So sometimes, like, the volume of posts on Twitter, while for entertainment purposes, can be great. Maybe for learning, sometimes that gets a lot of noise gets in the way of the signal.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I'm really grateful that I found FinTwit. And it's funny, like, when I went there, you know, I had just left the job and I was thinking, like, well, you know, should I ever need another job? I don't want to tell people while I was in a hole somewhere, you know, like doing work. And it's arguable whether or not some of the things I put out helps me professionally or not. But I think on average, it's probably a good thing. You know, it's led me to this podcast and stuff. And that's been really fun. But it has opened my mind to a way of thinking that I otherwise would not have had. You know, ironically, I wonder if some of the stuff that I trafficked in the beginning would have outperformed. But I also think that's sort of a function of where we're at right now. Like, I kind of liked commodity companies back then, and I think I would have gotten really lucky rather than being good in that particular area.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I hate to say something like this because it sounds so generic, but it's like, I feel like we're in a very interesting place in the cycle, right? Like COVID was such a disruptor, is such a crazy event. I still don't think we've worked through that craziness, like, especially the sales comps, the inventory shortages, the supply chain crunches, the growth that was pulled forward, like, et cetera, like all that stuff. There's something to, like, I kind of feel like there's high tides and low tides to investing, right? And you should never, when your style, there's lots of ways. Let's just say, I mean, like, that's, like I said, like, my philosophy comes down to, like, buying stocks with economic modes and holding for the long term. Like, no, in no way do I think that's, like, the only way to make money in the market, right? Like, that's what I think is best for me. And I think that's best for probably a lot of, like, retail investors who can't live and breathe this stuff every day. Like professionals, and like, hey, it's easy to tell them, like, hey, buy Alphabet, hold that stock for a long, long time, and just maybe even try to, like, dollar cost average into it every year. You know, put a, you know, you're talking to, like, a retail investor, put, hey, buy $1,000 of that stock every single year, you know, and you're going to probably be okay in the next 5 to 10 years. You're probably going to do very well. So there's something. Like, I like that philosophy for myself and for retail investors, but it's not the only way to make money.
Yeah. No, I think that that's, I think that's fair. And I think that the thing that dollar cost averaging does for people is you mitigate the risk that you're overpaying in the very beginning. I think you've got to, if that's the strategy, you got to make sure that you're not taking outsized position sizing in the beginning, because you've got to be able to have the dollar cost average sort of, like, work its way through your weighting, right? If you come out of the gate too big, then you really got to buy a lot more in order to buy down should you overpay.
That was, like, a mistake I think I made early on. And
I think it's a common mistake.
Yeah, like, where you just, well, I felt like you make, like, almost arbitrary rules for yourself, right? Like, okay, a position is, and when you're starting off, like, small sum. So it's like $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever it is, right? So you put all your money into it. Like, when I first started investing, I remember this vividly. My wife and I, we had $6,000, right, that we put into stocks. And, like, when that goes down, like, even if it's a great company, which when I started, they were not great companies. But even if you're like, okay, Alphabet, and you take some savings, $5,000, $10,000, whatever that amount is, and you put it into a company like Alphabet, and you bought it 6 months ago, a year ago, and right now you're like, oh, crap, like, what did I do? You know, like, I already bought, Alphabet was this one stock I bought last year, and I need to buy something else now. I want to diversify. So I think, like, taking smaller bites and just averaging into positions is a way to kind of, like, one, psychologically hack yourself to keep from getting too down into like these periods we're experiencing now in the market. It helps you with volatility because, you know, instead of buying $10,000 of Alphabet last year, I bought $2,000 of five stocks. And I'm making up numbers.
Yeah.
But like, okay, now I want to put another $2,000 into Alphabet. There's part of me that can get excited that I'm getting it at a cheaper price. And so it helps yourself like stick with that long-term holding by doing that. And also, you know, helps yourself like if you got the valuation wrong, if you got the intrinsic value wrong, it helps yourself to like alleviate some of those mistakes. Now, at the same time, look, granted, like if you got it at a great price last year, well, I don't know if anybody got anything at a great price last year.
Yeah, 2021 wasn't the time to buy things on sale.
Right, but now, if you got it at like the bottom of COVID, right? And then like the next year, you're buying another $2,000, like I should have bought more. And that's of course, right? Like, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, by averaging into stocks, I think for this kind of philosophy, and I think for retail investors, I think it can help like one, just psychologically hack yourself and to not get like too down when your stock is down because, hey, I'm going to buy more next year. So if it's still down next year, like, great. Now I can buy more of it. I can average down into a great company. Perfect. And if it's not still down next year, like it dips and it came up before I could buy more, well, then it really wasn't that big of a deal. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So the stock was down for 6 months, but then it rebounded. Like, okay, that's okay. Who cares about that 6 month blip? Okay. And maybe you didn't exploit it perfectly. That's okay. You know, like we're not going to exploit it perfectly. We're not going to buy the bottoms and trim at the tops perfectly. Never. So, that's definitely something I do and I encourage other people to do.
Well, I think you and I have pretty similar backgrounds in that we were trying to teach ourselves how to invest, right? And the thing that I've come to appreciate is there's, you know, this philosophy of buying you know, companies that are going to outperform expectations and selling those that are going to you know, miss, and trading acceleration and deceleration and second order derivatives of growth rates and all this stuff. And I get all of it, but at the end of the day, what resonates the most with me is like, look, if Google missed because their growth rate came in a little bit too low, their margins compressed a little bit because they were over earning, and you know, people are questioning their hiring decisions, I would much rather them run their business for the long term and buy into that weakness, which I'm not doing, but I'm just saying philosophically, I'd rather like buy into that weakness and avoid when everybody's cheerleading it, and everybody's saying it's great and, you know, all that. I tend not to like that, but like I tend to, I don't know. Let's put it this way. If I was at Google, and this may not be the nicest thing to say, but I would run it the exact same way, right? And maybe I don't know what I'm doing, but I would not worry at all about my hiring decisions and whether or not I'm going to make a quarterly number. And if anybody wanted to sell my stock because of it, I'd be like, guys, look at the business we are creating. If you don't want a part of this, like, fine.
Right. And Alphabet, the fact that we're talking about Alphabet makes this an easier discussion because I do feel like it's one of those. One, first off, just full disclosure, it's one of my largest positions.
I own it too.
Yeah, I've owned it for several years. And, you know, I think it has a wonderful moat with its, you know, the network. It's like has this data network effect, Google search engine improves because users conduct more searches on it and websites optimize themselves to figure like prominently in those search results. And, you know, then Google personalizes those search results, making it more likely those users are going to use Google the next time they conduct an online search. And you know, that just that their gap between them and their competitors, just grows like every day.
Well, let me ask you this though. How do you feel about their dependency and or symbiotic relationship with Apple and what kind of risk that poses to the business?
So that's probably the biggest risk, right? And so if you're not familiar with that, like Alphabet pays Apple a lot of money every year to be the default search engine on iPhones. So I believe that if you took that relationship away immediately, it would be like the next few years for Alphabet would look better because they're not paying Apple all that money. However, over the long term, that creates an opportunity for a competitor, whether that's Apple or like Microsoft all of a sudden like made a home run offer to let Bing be the default search, or Apple bought like DuckDuckGo or one of these other search engines to become the default. That obviously provides a huge opportunity for another competitor to come in and compete with Alphabet in their dominance in search. What I would say is like Alphabet's dominance allows it, gives it the luxury to paying that huge tax or fee to Apple. Now, like, yes, could a company like Microsoft make the same kind of offer? Absolutely. They have deep pockets. You know, I think Microsoft is doing a lot of things right. I think they have a lot of money over there. And of course, Apple could run, you know, a search engine as a loss leader for a long, long time. They're doing pretty good themselves. But one, I don't think either one, Apple or Alphabet, wants to test that out. Because if Apple made their own search engine and put a lot of money into it and stopped taking money from Alphabet, there's a good chance a lot of people, especially in the beginning, if it gets that reputation for just not being as good as Google. And I mean, I've tried to use Bing before. It is not. It's just not as good as Google. It's good for like two-thirds. It's, you know, two-thirds are, of it is as good. And then, but when you try to like get a real niche search for something, like Google's just better. I don't think Apple wants to test that either, because Apple's making a lot of money from just taking that check from Alphabet every year. And Alphabet doesn't want to test that either. So I think it's like this mutually beneficial position where neither really wants to test who would become the winner in that scenario.
It's kind of funny because you normally think about like a shark and a smaller fish, right? And the smaller fish is symbiotic with the shark, but this is like two sharks and they kind of like each other. I do hope if any listener listens to this and they disagree with what they're saying, please reach out to either me or Matt. I'm going to put Matt's, Twitter handle in the show notes, because I think both Matt and I are looking more to learn than to tell. But, you know, I've been thinking about Facebook's recent results. And,
Hang on, because
I think it goes to Google. So the amount of money that Facebook appears, in my understanding, to have to pay to solve the problem of no longer being able to access Apple's data, right? We're talking about $30 billion of incremental AI spend, I believe, was what they said. Google paid Apple, what, $15 billion, I think, in 2021, somewhere around there, maybe 17, maybe 12, whatever. But
yeah, in that ballpark, yeah.
So I think Apple's free cash flow is like $90 billion or so, which is eye-popping. It's incredible.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good.
You know, if you take that $15 billion out, and you've got a shareholder base that cares a lot about free cash flow yield, and you have customers that are very happy, like, I just don't know that it makes sense to try to upset the Apple cart. Huh? Good pun. When everybody, when it's a working relationship for all parties.
It does seem like it works for everyone. Yeah.
And I think Facebook may be a very instructive. I mean, look, Apple may come back to Google and say, we need $20 billion next year, right? Like, look at what we did to Facebook. That's very possible. I think right now, and hopefully, you know, these people know how to interact with each other in a mutually beneficial way, think it somewhat mitigates the risk, how well the relationship works.
It seems like it's a win-win right now for both those parties, even if it's an uneasy relationship, like a frenemy kind of relationship in that aspect.
Well, I think there are very few businesses that aren't frenemy types, right? There's natural conflict, I think, in many business relationships, but that doesn't mean that they can't continue.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You want to talk Facebook? Meta?
Oh, man. Well, this is a more interesting conversation. Like, I'll start. Like, my line has always been, when Zuck started really investing in the metaverse, and like change the company's name and the ticker and all that stuff. my line has always been, like, if the family of apps doesn't lose any users or engagement, everything else will be worked out or can be worked out. Like, it's just like, it's okay. Like, all that stuff can be worked out as long as the family of apps stays strong. And I'm like, I'm wondering if I'm doubting that now. Like, so full disclosure.
And he gave guidance that's very scary.
Like, full disclosure, I also own Facebook, and I've owned it for a long time, probably 7 or 8 years now. You know, and Bill, we've done work together on this in the past. You know, we talked to, like, our friends in the online advertising world, you know, Kevin Ekmark and Milo McMahon. Check out their Twitter accounts, but they've been helpful.
Shout out to them.
But, you know, the pace at which Zuck is burning through his cash flow, is that unprecedented? Like, I'm trying not to just use that word lightly, but I mean,
when you see total expenditures exceeding 100 billion or projected to be 100 billion, and let's say they're overstating it, right? So it's 90 billion. I mean, that is a yearly spend that is unfathomable to me. That used to be a lot of money, and I think it still is.
Yeah, it might be a lot of money. Inflation. 90 billion here and 90 billion there, you know?
It starts to add up.
The P and the PE ratio keeps getting better. But that E in that PE ratio, yeah, not looking so hot.
Yeah, and it also the E understates the you know, the cash flow, right? Yeah. Because you're outspending your depreciation amortization by quite a bit.
There's a lot there, and so I haven't really had a chance to, like, dive super deep into the quarter yet. I don't know when you plan to release this, but it was just this week when they reported earnings.
Yeah, it'll probably be next week.
But I will say, like, to me, Alphabet is a much clearer picture. Yeah. Like, to me, like, I can hold Alphabet with confidence and say, look, Al, any volatility we see right now for what we were talking about, their hiring practices or you know, anything else, I'm pretty confident in saying, like, hey, I'm going to hold through this and I'm not too worried about this long term. Meta is a much murkier picture. There's something to be said that, like, Zuck has led through some pretty big pivots in Facebook history and done very well there. When he bought Instagram, I mean, now that seems like chump change for $1 billion. But for years, like, people were talking about how he overpaid for it still.
Yeah, I was one of those people. I was pretty wrong in retrospect.
Right, right. All that being said, like, so.
This is a big pivot, though. You're talking about hardware. You're talking about a new computing system.
It's a big pivot. And $1 billion is not $90 billion a year.
Yeah, I think how I think about this is I'm 85% sure that if you're just looking at the metaverse spend and you say, well, I can add that back, that's the wrong way to look at it. I think 75% sure that it's an NPV negative spend, right? So I do think this is going to, it has and will detract from the enterprise value. I don't know how long it will go on. I don't know. I think it's risky when you're a minority shareholder and you're investing with somebody that is that wealthy. The incentives are not necessarily the same. And even though he owns a lot of the company, like, I'm sure he's got a lot more than he needs in a couple lifetimes liquid. So, you know, he's got control. You've got to sign up to be with him. Open letters or not. I don't think it really matters. I don't think that those things are going, like, if I were him and somebody wrote me an open letter or was communicating with me and I disagreed, I'd just be like, okay, what have you done in your life? And that's maybe not somebody you want to invest with, by the way, but that would be my default position, I think, if I were him, because guy's on top of the world. How can anybody tell him what to do? And I think that's the risk. But to your point, I thought family of apps, did a lot better than I thought maybe they would do. And I thought that there were some interesting disclosures on how big click to I'm going to mess up what it's called, but like click to messaging or whatever it is.
The click to messaging. Right. Right.
Yeah. And there were some interesting disclosures, I think, a little bit about how he's thinking about WhatsApp and whatnot. So we'll see. But it's definitely a capital allocation discount.
yeah.
Or appropriately priced capital allocation. We'll all find out together.
You know, I remember my timeline's a little blurry here, but like, you know, either earlier this year or last year, like articles were out, like saying like he was Zuckerberg in his mind was tying his legacy to like his metaverse vision.
Yeah.
And I thought that was scary. And, yeah. Then, you know, we heard about like hiring freezes and like some other things they said in the conference calls earlier this year. And I'm like, okay, like, you know, Zuckerberg is maintaining some hold on fiscal sanity here. And that's, I don't want this to be a religious vision for him. I want this business vision for him.
I think it's closer to religion.
And I'm that's my big concern. And that this is almost like his, if he thinks his legacy is tied to this success, if he thinks this is like something the world needs, or, you know, for whatever reason that he needs to be remembered for creating this. Like, I want to say like there was an article that like saying like this was his iPhone moment, you know, like for Steve Jobs. And like, that's not good. you know, I want to hear.
No, it definitely isn't. I think the most important question, I think the most important issue on this particular topic is if it is his religion and it doesn't go well for 2 to 3 years, right? I think the market is certainly bearish on its prospects. I definitely question the probability of success. I wonder whether or not he can sort of say, you know what, I gave it my best shot and I lost and that sucks, but at least I'm not living with any regret, and I'm going to shut down a lot of this, and some of the tech that we built we can license out or make some money on, and we'll move on. But I think to expect him to do that within 3 years is like a very unrealistic expectation. And 3 years is a long time to live through getting pelted with a negative stock reaction and negative surprises on CapEx. It's easier said in a spreadsheet or, you know, theoretically than lived.
And with how much money they're spending on it too, that threshold, that hurdle of what you can define success as is really high.
Yeah.
If you had said like 2 or 3 years ago, before they changed the name of the company, and before this huge pivot, like, hey, we're going to put a lot of money in Oculus, a lot. And we, you know, this could be the Xbox of the future. This could be like, hey, we think this like has potential, and there might be some other interesting use cases here. Like, that's something like, okay, that's cool. You know, like, try to be the Xbox of 2025 on or whatever. And then maybe there's optionality there for other use cases. But pouring this much money into it, I mean, what your definition of success has to be so high. That's a very, very high hurdle to reach. And, you know, like, you know, Xbox, that's a nice business line from Microsoft. That's, you know, that's great. But it's not their core business by any means. And, you know, for a long time, I kind of just thought that's what this Oculus stuff was all about, something like that. And instead, now it's becoming like, you know, like almost like your entire digital experience, you know, or he wants this to be everybody's consumer digital experience. And that's a really high hurdle.
Yeah. I think if I were him, I don't agree with what he's doing, but I think I can understand it. It's completely uneconomic though, because if you think about like how would you fund, like if this was a venture capital company trying to raise capital to go do what he's doing, you're not raising debt, right? So it's all equity funding. And given where rates are and your opportunity cost to capital, like I have to think the hurdle rate, if you were raising outside capital, would be 20%. There's just no way it's going to hit that hurdle rate. I don't think. I mean, maybe I'll turn out to be wrong, but like, oof, it's going to take a long time to get there.
It's going to take a long time and a lot of money to get there every single year. If you could see this more as like, we had to spend a lot of money this year and next year, but then it's going to like rapidly decrease, or these are one-time expenses, but they don't seem to be. And that's the scary thing as a shareholder. Like this, so, you know, we're talking about long-term buy and hold. hashtag never sell, where I believe. And this is where, like, you know, this is where it gets hard, because now I'm looking at this company and, you know, if you, you know, if you want to go back to like the bigger picture, like just investment philosophy, like every stock, you know, what I used to do, like when I first started, and I don't know why, but like probably speaks to my intelligence level, but like I would look at a long-term chart, like a think of any great stock, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, IBM, McDonald's, Walmart, just take your pick. And I'm talking about like those 50-year charts, and you could like find a time on any of those charts where like, man, if you bought it, you know, I'm making up numbers, but like, you know, if you bought Johnson & Johnson in 1972, you know, at the peak, you didn't see any returns for 6 years or 5 years. I mean, there, any stock you can take a 5-6 year period where, hey, that if you bought at the peak right there, I mean, you for 5 or 6 years, it's easy to look on a 50-year chart and be like, oh, that's nothing, that's a blip. Like, of course, of course, Johnson & Johnson is a great company, and of course, Coca-Cola is a great company, and you should have sold it then. But if you bought it at that time, you're living through 5 years of like, why did I buy this stinker? You know, like Johnson & Johnson, I bought it at the peak, and whatever happened to it at whatever time, you know, like something happened. Maybe it was overvalued. Maybe it like had a bad business line. Maybe it was the Tylenol recall in the early 80s, whatever it was. You know, it was seeing that like downturn. But that being said, for every Johnson & Johnson, there's probably five where, hey, Polaroid or Kodak or, you know, eventually maybe IBM is there now, right? Where like they started this long decline and never recovered. And that's what, you know, if you're in never sell, you know, you have to be careful of.
Yeah.
So you have to balance that. Like every great company will see downturns. Every great company will see volatility. And if it's a truly great company, if you hold through that, it's going to be great. And if you average down, it'll be great, even better. You know, is this the Kodak moment for Facebook, you know? Or, and that's what, you know.
Or like when Buffett bought Coke, right? And it was, you know, Coke didn't have great capital allocation and they were messing around in other tangential areas. But, you know, that's so much easier to say in retrospect, like, oh, yeah, you should have bought it now. Okay, well, maybe, right? But maybe not. I don't know. I own a very small amount. It's a lot smaller now. I have not. I've been reticent since we did our work. I have not added, and I'm happy that that's the case. But we'll see how it goes out.
Yeah, I don't know the last time I added, but I have added over the years a lot to Facebook. And even though my original buy, so this is where that dollar cost averaging gets you in trouble. My original buy is still below where it is now. Over the years, when I've averaged into it, I'm down overall on my position because of averaging in.
You're not alone, man. A lot. I mean, that stock has erased a lot of years of gains.
A lot of years. A lot of.
But I do think, and then I want to move on a little bit. But I do think that, like you know, like the narrative. I don't think truth is being told in what people are saying about that company right now. I think reality. Is he's got the core business somewhat stabilized, whether or not people want to believe that or not. I think that the data supports that statement. It's a question of whether or not how much he'll blow and how much you want to capitalize those losses that I think really, really matters. And those are very hard questions to answer, especially when somebody has complete control.
Yeah, they are hard questions. Yeah. Is this a religious experience or is this a business venture that he'll eventually realize is not successful?
Yeah. So you know, when you're talking for I'm thinking of you're very knowledgeable in payments, and one of the things that I was kind of curious about is you like there's this juxtaposition of I don't know that just juxtaposition is the right word, but like how do I say this company properly? Is it Adyen?
Yeah.
So yeah. Do you mind explaining what is so unique about that company? And also, like that company to me has traded at this valuation that, kind of makes my stomach churn for a while. The business results are excellent from what I can gather, but I obviously don't understand it very well. But like, how do you think about, do I want to participate in something like that that's trading at a very high valuation, but the business prospects appear quite good from everything I read.
So before talking about Adyen specifically, so like this is a company that like, so when there's a company like this, a lot of times, and this is what I did in Adyen's case. So it's a good example. Like I'll buy a very small position. Like, I mean, minuscule, like less than probably now. Like, I mean, it fluctuates obviously. Like when it was going up for a long time, it was probably rose above 1% of my portfolio. And now it's probably down below 1% of my portfolio, but I have a very small position in Adyen. And what I like to do in cases like that is like to buy a small piece and just to kind of like one that for whatever reason that psychologically just motivates me to keep tabs on it better than to say yeah. like it's on my watch list and you know then it gets lost in the shuffle and it's up 50 times or down 50 times and I missed it or whatever. So like when there's a company like that that I think is overvalued but like man I really like that company. I'll buy a small, a lot of times I will buy a small position and just kind of like watch it. And buying that small position really helps me watch it. About Adyen. So, payments is all about scale and volume, right? So like you can become very profitable, as a payments company where, you know, you're processing payments and the more you process, the more profitable you can become because you're taking very small slices of each transaction. So, you know, if you have a thousand transactions coming to you for a dollar, you're taking a small slice. But if you can make that a million transactions going through you and you're taking that small slice, then all of a sudden for the same infrastructure, like all of a sudden.
Yeah, you have a lot of fixed cost leverage.
Right, right. So payments can be very profitable. And that's why MasterCard and Visa, I mean, tremendous businesses. Now, those are the networks, so that's different. So what happened for a long time is you had a lot of consolidation in the industry because these companies figured out, like you can look at like Fiserv or Global Payments or, I'm trying to think of all like the legacy companies in this space, but like they just started consolidating because they were basically buying volume and becoming very profitable. So I'm going to explain this in my very layman terms.
Yeah, please technical. Do. But yeah, pretend I'm like five because that's where my brain is. And let's talk.
Well, it's good. We're on the same wavelength. Yeah. We're on the same wavelength. So it's perfect. Like, but basically, like you're cobbling together all these systems. And, you know, that might not be the most optimal solution behind the scenes, right? Like your data is going to be very clunky and dispersed. And it's very hard if you're a big multinational corporation to get a hold of all your payments data in one place to really see how the big picture looks at one time. It's hard. Payments companies don't have that data, so they can't help you out so much because they're all these legacy systems that they kind of cobbled together and use duct tape, you know, to like, you know, it's very profitable. But because using these acquisitions is not ideal to build a global payments system infrastructure. So what Adyen did was like they basically these guys they were at WorldPay, I believe, which was acquired by Global Payments or acquired by a bank and then acquired by Global Payments. I might be getting that mixed up. There's so many acquisitions in this industry, it's hard to keep track of. But they were at a good company, it got acquired, and they said, you know what, we can do this better. And they built it basically from the ground up, and they've never made an acquisition. And, you know, so it's one system, it's modern infrastructure, you know, the technical infrastructure behind it is very modern. So like if you go to Adyen, if you're a big corporation like McDonald's or Nike or what, you know, I don't know off the top of my head who their customers are, but all of a sudden now you have a better look at your payments data than you ever had before. And Adyen has this data and they can like sell solutions using this data like to these companies too. And so it's a very slick user experience. It's a very it's a comprehensive look at a company's data, and so like so it's just better. And there's very few modern payments structures set up like that. You know, PayPal's Braintree is probably one. You know, Stripe is probably one, but Stripe is a little different. Stripe is more for online payments and it's a slick way to make online payments, but like, you know, it might not be as comprehensive as Adyen is. From how I understand it, Adyen is better for like, if you're a Nike or you're McDonald's and you have sales everywhere, you know, Adyen is better for someone like that. If I'm making a website and I want to charge, you know, and I need people to subscribe and charge money to them, Stripe is a great solution for me to just plug in and have it to go. But there's very few modern payment infrastructures out there. So Adyen just has this, like, because they built it the hard way and built it from the ground up and didn't, because again, acquisitions are so profitable in this industry because you're just buying volume and more transactions. But because Adyen shunned that, they now have this amazing modern infrastructure.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. All and right. So if you are thinking about where this business is in 10 years, is this one of those type of businesses that it's, this is how I think about Netflix. People don't understand. I'm not talking about the stock. Forget about the stock. I'm talking about the business. I think it's almost inevitable that Netflix will be a lot larger in the future. And I think a lot of the reason is that there's a lot of legacy incentives and structures that will prevent it's an innovator's dilemma issue, right? So do you view like Adyen as one of these companies that's just like almost endowed with the right to gain share over time because the incumbents cannot react based on how they are set up and the incentive structure?
Yes. Like I think Adyen will be a winner. It's come down a lot, so that's helped you with your...
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about stocks. Forget about stocks. Okay. The business.
Yeah, I think Adyen is in a very good position to eventually win business. Okay, so now that being said, right, if you're on one of these legacy infrastructures, you've made it work for a long time.
Yeah.
And something that these like legacy companies can do because they have so much volume is charge a very small amount. And now, look, Adyen's gaining scale. So the more you gain scale, the more you can lower prices. But if you're looking at sheer volume, if you're a Walmart and you're looking at sheer volume, you know, you're making this work. Could you look at Adyen and say, okay, this is a better system, but do we have to pay them more? Do we have to, we're making what we have work. What is the moat for these companies? It's switching costs, right? So like it's the high switching costs. If I have a business and I have like, you know, a regional supermarket chain or something like that, and I'm on one of these legacy systems and it's working, do I want to go through the headache of switching and training all my employees to use the new cashiers or the new payments or, you know, how all that works, train all my people in the back office on this new way we're collecting data and the new way we're processing payments. And like, God forbid, like day one, when we're trying to install it, it doesn't work or, you know, something like that. Like, do I want to go through all those potential headaches and pay a little more money for a better system? So what I'm trying to say is, yes, I think Adyen is in a great position to win, but it could be a very slow win.
Yeah.
Like it could be, it's not like they're not coming in and they don't have such, in my mind, they don't have such a disruptive solution that they're just going to like all of a sudden, all the big corporations are going to be switching over to it. These corporations, one, they care about how much they're paying. And, they care about every basis point and they're making what they have now work. And do they want to go through that headache of going through, you know, going to another solution?
Yeah.
So it could be a very slow win is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then I would think if you have a sales process, perhaps the answer is you give them a discount up front, right? Because you want them on for a long time, but then you've got migration costs and you're really investing a lot up front for the back end relationship, which can cost a lot.
And a lot of these companies, they want different solutions. So they'll say, this region, you use this system, this region, you use this system, you know, different systems. And that way you're not beholden to one of these companies that can start jacking up prices on you. Because if Global Payments starts jacking up prices, you'll be like, well, I'm going to start giving more business to First Data, right? Or more business to, you know, like these other legacy systems. So a lot of them purposely will not just go to one system. Now, again, that affects your data collection. That affects like other things in the back office. But again, when you're like one of these giants, Walmart, McDonald's, you know, you name your retail giants, you know, every basis point matters. Every basis point matters. And you, especially when you're talking about that volume of transactions. So, you know, they're, Adyen's in a great position. I love what they have. I have a very small position. I probably don't watch it as closely as I should. I haven't done deep work on it in a while. It's a great company, but I think it's going to be, I don't necessarily think it's going to be a very fast win. Like taking these customers off their legacy systems when it works and when they're paying like what they consider a good price for it, that's not easy.
Yeah. Reminds me a little bit of Guidewire, right? You've studied that. I've been studying that. It's like, it's one of those things that's pretty interesting. And it's it's funny how like my natural thought is, they should win, right? Like that's how it should be. But there's the world that is and the world that should be. And the world that is matters a whole lot.
Yes. Yeah. The world that is kind of matters, right? Was that Yogi Berra quote? In theory and practice are the same, but in practice, like they're
completely quotes. Different. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. And yes. Then it's like Buffett's, you know, it's a bird in the hand versus two in the bush. But then the question is, when are the two in the bush? And as a minority shareholder, when they're in the bush, are they going to go into the metaverse or are they going to return the cash to me? Like there's a lot of questions here in this game.
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with Guidewire, it's like this, it's this platform for specifically built for property and casualty insurers. And it combines like core operations and digital engagement, analytics, like applications delivered as this like cloud service, or they still have like on-premise like software. And it's a great, by all accounts, it's this great platform for these insurers. But when they're on their legacy system, whatever that is, so that could just be like very old databases, you know, and they're making it work, that's a very hard process to move everything over to, you know, a more modern system like Guidewire, where you can do more with your data analytics. Maybe you can offer better pricing. You know, data analytics, you think, would be very important to insurance companies, you know, and I have a position in Guidewire. But I think when you, the great thing about Adyen or Guidewire, right? I think it's very similar. It's like they just have, once they have a customer, like they're keeping that customer, right? And that's what I really like. I love those high switching costs. Like, you know, Oracle might be the best like example of like a company with a high switching cost, right? Like a couple of years ago, like Amazon wrapped up its project where it was like, you know, they had this huge team dedicated to like moving all of their I want to say they had like 100 petabytes, which is like, you know, like I can't even mathematically, like I can't even get my head around like the number that is, but like of internally stored data on like these thousands of Oracle databases. And when they finally finished, it took like a decade for them to move off of Oracle onto like their own servers. Like you're talking about the maker and, you know, origin of AWS. And then they were, you know, in this blog post, they celebrated and they're talking about like, oh, we had this reduction of cost by X% and latencies reduced by X% and admin overhead is down. You know, and with all those benefits, it took Amazon, like a decade to like make that switch, you know? And so, you know, if it's that hard for Amazon to get off Oracle, like, you know, it is really hard for these, you know, if you're a PNC insurer going to Guidewire, or you're like a retailer going to like a new payment system, you know, like when your system of truth is on a system, it's really hard to make that switch, you know, like that's a really daunting prospect. Not only is it hard, like you're worried about like, hey, we're worried about business disruption during this transition, but then you're basically like, you're going to have employees who are basically working themselves out of a job because they work on these old databases and that's what they're trained on. And, you know, you have to train all your new employees on the new system. Like, there's just a lot of headaches that come with like switching from these like platforms that you're that's ingrained in your business. But when you do make that switch, and, you know, if you're a shareholder in Guidewire or Adyen, like, you're hoping like, well, that's how hard it's going to be for these companies to get off of them too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would imagine that the majority of the workforce is probably on a weighted average age north of 32. And I don't think that once you get that old, I think that's young, by the way, but learning new systems is not like the easiest thing in the world. I used to think that software was pretty easy to switch from. And then somebody was like, I think it might have been Rishi, but somebody was like, when's the last time you learned a new software system? And I was like, yeah, that's a pretty good point. It's not intuitive at all.
Yeah, 32 is a kid. Let's just get that straight.
yeah, no doubt. Yeah. But I think a lot of your habits are ingrained by then in certain ways.
If your career is based on a system to make us change, and it's easy for someone like me to say, well, it's coding or whatever, like, you know, that's your job. But if you're coding in COBOL or, you know, whatever, Python, and you got to switch to, I'm throwing out languages like I know what I'm talking about, but like, you got to change to another coding system. You know, you got to change from Java to Python or Python to COBOL or whatever. Yes, of course. And especially now, if you're a company, hey, I have five of these coders or the programmers, computer engineers, software engineers who know this system.
Yeah.
You know, and now I have to have five who know this system. Can I train these guys to switch over? If I don't train these guys and I'm telling them I'm making this switch, they know they're working themselves out of a job. So how do I keep them motivated? How do I keep them from making this a smooth transition? And do they want to be trained? So now, you know, like, okay, even if you're willing to train them to learn this new thing, like, you know, like at my day job, when the administration tries to make a switch on something, like people's schedules or whatever, there's a lot of critical feedback from the rank and file, right?
By critical feedback, you mean people that are really upset.
Correct. And if you're a business, I mean, you know, there's a labor crunch out there right now. You know, these are all things like businesses have to go through. So if your moat is at high switching cost, it can be hard to win new customers, because usually something's inherent to that type of business that makes it hard to switch. But the good thing about a company, if you're a shareholder in Adyen or Guidewire, you know, and I think even on a bigger scale, like, that's what you could talk about, AWS, Azure. Like, once a company's on these clouds and these platforms, man, it's hard to get off. It's hard to get off.
You said earlier that you look for wide moats. How are you thinking about watching when a moat changes and sort of monitoring that? It's very hard to figure out, right?
It's very hard to figure out. We were talking about Meta, and that's what makes it so hard, because I feel like the moats I cared about are still intact, and then they're doing all these other things. But like, generally, the direction of the moat might be even more important than the moat itself. So Oracle, I mentioned Oracle about these immense high switching costs, and I think those exist. But is that moat shrinking or expanding? I think it's shrinking. I think they're, you know, these other platforms, the AWS, the Azures of the world, are better and can offer more modern infrastructure and better applications, and which comes with like better AI applications and better like analytics and better pricing, you know, because these companies like Oracle have basically abused their customers for decades, right? So there's not a lot of love from their customers for these companies either. So I'm not in Oracle, and I believe it has a moat, right? Its moat is immense. I think it's shrinking, and because their customers don't love it, like, there's something to be said. Like, sometimes when customers hate a company, but yet they still going back to them, like, that's probably evidence of a moat. And yet when alternatives present themselves, those customers will be definitely looking at those alternatives. as a way to like get out from it. So you have to look at a direction of a moat. And, you know, like a lot of my fellow advisors at Seven Investing, they like getting in those companies that are probably creating a moat than have a moat. Whereas I'm more like
emergent moats.
Yeah. And whereas I'm probably more on the side of like, I look for more established moats that I believe already exist. You know, I don't want to attribute something to Warren Buffett that he didn't say, but I thought, you know, he said like at any time, like a moat is like either shrinking or growing. And you know, that's something to really look at. I don't know if Buffett said that, but somebody did. And I think that's probably right. You know, there's very few companies, Moody's is one or S&P Global, where like that moat just seems like, you know, it would almost take an act of the regulatory gods to disrupt it, because I don't see how that changes in the private markets. And I do, you know, I have a position in Moody's, you know, but one thing I like to look at is like a moat attack. So this is an idea I got from Poland Capital, which is an active money manager. Like Bill, I don't think they're too far away from you, but like,
I think they're closer to you, but they're
between us.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And, they talk about moat attacks being like, think about when Microsoft made Bing, right? So like, this is a great example. You have this like great company, Microsoft, putting a lot of money into a product that's going to like, try to get a big share of the search engine market. And, you know, they tried and it didn't work, which that gives me confidence that like, there is a real moat with Google search business. If Microsoft can't do it, the maker of Windows, the maker of, at the time, the most popular browsers, you know, if they couldn't distribute their search engine enough to disrupt Google's dominance in search engines, to me, that's like that's a great evidence of a moat that is strong.
Yeah.
You know, you can look at other, you know, there's constant examples, but like, you know, a long time ago, I'm going to mess this example up, but a long time ago, let's just stick with like that. You know, Home Depot tried to make a competitor to Tractor Supply. But Tractor Supply is this retailer in rural areas that like sells like feed to animals and, you know, garden seeds and like basically like these outdoor for the like, you know, we talk about retail investors. These are like retail farmers, right? Like, you know, you have a large backyard and you want to grow stuff and, you know, the Tractor Supply caters to them and they do a wonderful job. Home Depot tried to make a competitor to them and it just didn't work. It fizzled out. Like that's probably an evidence like Tractor Supply has something really going. And if a company like Home Depot couldn't compete with them, that already sells like a really similar product base, you know, it's probably going to be really hard for somebody to disrupt them. You can go back to like, you know, we talked about like Google search engine dominance, but when they tried to enter the social media world with Google Plus and all these things, like Facebook's moat stood strong. You know, they couldn't disrupt that. So, so I like to look for good examples of moat attacks, where like, okay, there's precedence here for thinking that, that this company's advantage is strong and like, you know, Microsoft tried to enter the search engine market. It just couldn't do it. I mean, Bing has like, I mean, whatever it is, it's like 2% market share or something after a decade of trying. I mean, you can get discounts. You can get like, you know, coupons and discounts and gift cards for using Bing at different times. They tried these promotions. And I see that. I'm like, that's a smart idea. And I never use it. You know, like, it, like I just never use it because I use Google. And you know, so I want to look for moat attacks, I think is a way to do it. Another way, like something I think like is a great mental model, and this is from Buffett, but basically like, and I butcher quotes all the time, so forgive me, but like, you know, Buffett says something once like, if you give me $1 billion, could I disrupt Coca-Cola? Could I make another soda that competes with Coca-Cola? And I don't know the exact amount Buffett said, but like, I think that's like, a great mental model to use. Like Bill, if somebody gave us $1 billion or $10 billion, we'll pick a figure to make a competitor to Chipotle, right? Oh, like there's this market, this Mexican food quick service restaurant market is huge, and we want to get into it. And Bill and Matt, here's $1 billion or $5 billion or $10 billion, make a competing concept. I mean, with that much money, you know, as dumb as I am, like we could probably come up with like a reasonably competent restaurant that, you know, if that, that could potentially do well, could do okay. Could, you know, we, there's a chance we could make a profitable restaurant chain with a lot of money, if we were given a lot of money, like to compete against Chipotle. But could I do that for MasterCard or Visa? Like, could I do that for Moody's or S&P Global? No. Like, or I don't see how I could, right? So I think that's a great mental model to use too. Like, so yeah. I look for mode attacks. If a company's trying to get into a market and they can't do it, that might be evident that that company, that the legacy company there has a real moat. And like, hey, if, could I make a Mexican quick service restaurant if somebody gave me a lot of money? Yeah. Yeah, I probably could. I know nothing about the restaurant industry, so I'm probably overstating my ability there. But like, somebody could. Somebody like maybe if I hired a good person to do it, right? Like, somebody could do that, I think. And Chipotle's great. I'm not, you know, I don't have anything against Chipotle.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like,
but that's the way you're thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I like that mental model, and I like the idea of a mode attack. Looking for that.
I think. I'm super interested to see with Chipotle and Disney for totally different reasons, but I just I wonder if they weren't public, would they be making the same pricing decisions that they are? And are these pricing decisions going to push the envelope just a little bit too far? But there are companies that I've been saying that about for a long, long time, and every year they raise price and every year people pay. So, you know, especially Disney.
When you talk about Disney, you're talking about like their park price tickets or their park.
Yeah, man. Tickets? I think it's getting expensive. I mean, it's always been expensive. That's why they sell the shirts that say I went broke. But I don't know. I talked to some annual pass holders lately that are switching to Universal. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And the thing that...
The park experience, right, at Disney, I will not say it's not joyful, because when you look at your kids and they have this look in their eye, like that's magic, right? But the other side of it, man, is messing around with the genie, waking up at 7 a.m., two people have to be on devices, you hope that you can get onto a line, you know, if you don't, it's just... I don't know, man. It just feels nickel and dimey at this point. And I wonder if Walt would be proud of where it's been taken.
And the thing I wonder about them is, like, I think for making the parks profitable, just if they were looking purely at the best way they can monetize the parks, they're probably doing a good job. And they could probably even have more room to increase prices because there's a finite capacity at those parks. And especially after COVID, there's just this huge rush. People like, we want to go do things, and yeah. You know, obviously Disney parks is a big idea near the top for a lot of families, but like, to me, if you're Disney, and I know they know this, but it's like sometimes I think like they forget, like it's their park experience, it's not just about the parks, it's to like forge these bonds. When you bring your 8-year-old there and they see Darth Vader or they see Mickey Mouse or they see, you know, whatever, Woody, Buzz Lightyear, you know, take your pick of a character, or your 8-year-old girl and they see the, you know, the princesses, Anna, Elsa, you know, whatever. That 8-year-old falls in love with those characters, right? Like they see Buzz Lightyear, they take a picture of Buzz Lightyear, then they go on the Buzz Lightyear ride and they shoot the laser guns, or they throw the rings around the, you know, like all the carnival things on the ride at Hollywood Studios. And they fall in love with those characters. And then when they're 38 years old, they're taking their 8-year-old to the park, and because they're showing those same movies that they watched in 1992, you know, to their kids in 2022. And then vice versa, you know, and so
sort
on.
Of.
So
I showed my kids the old Hook and I was like, oh boy, this is not okay to watch. But anyway, or Peter Pan or whatever. I was like,
right, oof. Right.
Anyway, but yes, I do know what you're saying.
You just wonder if they outprice the middle class from going to the parks.
Yes,
you're losing all those people from forging those bonds with those characters.
Agreed. You know? And yes, then the other thing, man,
the the Toy Story movies, and that's great. But it, like, what reinforces that forever is like going to those parks and going on the rides and seeing the characters and having this amazing day, and like that's just burned in your memory as an 8-year old for forever. And if you price out the middle class, then like you're losing that generation. I just there's more to it for Disney than just monetizing the park experience.
This is where I think being a public company may be a problem in the long, long term. Because, and the other thing, man, is like you pay all this money, you go to these, you know, like, oh, meet your person, you know, whatever, the character breakfast. And like the buffet food is crap. I mean, like, just invest a little and give up a little bit of margin and give me something that's like good. And it's fine for kids, but for those prices, it's like, what? I don't know. I would have said this a long, long time ago, and I would have been wrong and whatever. So I'm probably just the guy that's wrong again. But it just doesn't feel like that experience to me still exists for exactly what you just said, like the middle class to go and have an affordable maybe not once in a lifetime, but like,
right.
Can't replace or replicate that experience. And I think they're getting a lot closer to how do we hit our EPS and how do we, you know, jack up park prices so that we can subsidize this. And it makes me nervous.
That's a great question. If they'd be better off as not a public company, because are they feeling the pressure to show margins at a park, like, you know, 200 basis points higher than it should be or could be, you know, but like to please Wall Street instead of like it, but lose the middle class.
Who knows? Maybe they won't. Maybe the middle class doesn't care. But it's offensively expensive to me.
It used to be, and maybe this is just purely anecdotal, but like it used to be, it was the best experience you could get though. Like it was just so much better experience than another amusement park because it was more than the rides. They looked at the details so much better. And now I feel like, to your point, going to Universal, going to
Busch Universal Gardens, is a good park.
Going to these other parks, if it's just as good, then like, you know, for Disney to charge what they charge and to then nickel and dime the customers with these additional charges, Genie, Lightning, and whatever else they have. You know, it has to be the best. It has to be the best. And you feel like it's not anymore, at least not by the same margin it used to be.
Yeah, and I think it's still the most unique, right? For the reasons that you said, I can't go to Universal and get my connection with the same characters or whatever, but I can go there and have a whole lot of fun. So we'll see.
And you can make connections with their characters, the Dr. Seuss, the Grinch, or, you know, whatever other characters they have there.
Yeah, Minions or whatever. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. What has been, I guess, how do you feel about being a public figure commenting on finance as somebody who taught yourself? I think we have that in common. I have mixed feelings about it, but on average, the net benefits far exceed the costs. But curious to hear your thoughts.
That's an interesting question. You know, it's probably just something I don't think about that much. You know, there's parts of it that are annoying. I mean, you know this, like, I mean, I have two jobs. And so like sometimes, like, you know, like last night, Amazon reported and people are like DMing me or messaging me and like, what do you think of the quarter? What do you think of the quarter? Like, what do you think of this? And I'm like, man, I don't know yet. You know, I'll try to chime in, by the way. I'm going to try to chime in about a week and I'll let you know. But like, I don't, 2 hours after the call, like, I don't know, you know, yeah. I don't know yet. I don't have an informed opinion. And then that's where I get myself in trouble. I start scrolling on Twitter and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's horrible. Or the other way, you know, when times are good, like, oh, this is amazing, you know, and you start forming your opinion from like, you know, these other people's takes instead of like just doing the work. And then you go into a quarter with like preconceived notions. Like that's something I need to guard against. You know, what I'll say is, it's like, I remember very well, like what it's like not knowing anything about investing or anything about money and thinking it was beyond me. right? Thinking like, well, I can't learn that. That's for, like, I grew up in a very working class home, and you know, investing was something like rich people did, and it wasn't for normal people, or the, you know, it wasn't for, you know, it wasn't for the working class. And like, what if I have a mission, or if I like, I want to like let people know, like, that's not true. You can do this, you know, with a reasonable set of confidence. And that could mean like, just whatever. That could just mean putting your money into an S&P 500 fund. And that could mean like putting most of your money into an S&P 500 fund. But if there's a couple companies you like, and like, try to do some basic work on, and you kind of just inherently, you know, that Peter Lynch thing of like, buy what you know. And that's, a lot of times people boil down his message to buy what you know. And there was so much more to it than that. But like, he was like, that's a good place to start. He didn't say that was the whole process, but that's a good place to start. If there's something in your industry where you work, if there's something as a consumer, you know, like I have a coworker at work who like, you know, this is goes back years, but you know, she loved Lululemon, and I didn't know much about it as a company, but I'm like, you know, a lot of people think it's a good stock. Why don't you put a little money into it? You know, you love this company. And she did. And like, and obviously that worked out very well for her. And like, it's like, the, like, I want to let people know, like, you can do this. Like, unfortunately, like my industry and this, like, you know, these, probably got people caught up in a lot of hype the last couple of years. And I'm not accusing anyone or any one newsletter. I'm just saying like the whole, like there's probably, that's how actually how I got into investing was, you know, I was up late one night and my wife had stayed home for years. We were having kids and she was staying at home mother for a while. And I was a young cop and like we were barely making ends meet, but she was going back to work. And so I'm like, wow, we're living on my salary. And something in my head was like, okay, I know enough to like, we should do something with this money. Like when she goes back to work, we shouldn't just increase our lifestyle. And so she was going back to work and I was up really late one night. I was on the midnight shift. So I was always up late. And like, I saw this like 30 minute, like ad for like 3D printing stocks. And I just was like, I was completely enthralled with it, right? I mean, I was just like completely like, wow, this is the future. Like I got so into it. So I started like, I ordered on Amazon a few books on it. And I was like, wow, like one of the books said, like, you know, when you move in the future, when you move from LA to Florida in the future, you're not, think about how inefficient it is to pack all your belongings in a truck and drive it all the way across the country. What you're going to do is you're just going to scan in everything you have. And when you get to your new house, you're just going to print it out.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
And I'm like,
I don't know what we're going to do with all the waste, but yes, I agree with you.
The details, Bill, details.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. It's like, wow, this is amazing. Right. Like my small brain was like, this is incredible. This is going to be so great. And so I put like whatever savings we had at the time, which wasn't much, into like 3D printing socks. And for 6 months, I'm like, this is easy.
Yeah.
This is so great, man. Like I just like doubled our money in 6 months. I mean, like, oh, that was so easy, you know? Like all you gotta do is buy these stocks. And then like, you know, this is like 2013, 2014. And you know, if you're familiar with the story, like those stocks absolutely crashed. And it got to the point where like, okay, I had liked the idea. I started to like this idea of investing. I started reading books like Peter Lynch, and I got involved in the Motley Fool community and on discussion boards, asking questions. And I was like, okay, I like this idea of investing, but my wife's not going to let me keep doing this. Right. Like I can't say like, no, I'm investing all our money, but keep losing it because these stocks were just cratering. And so that just like, you know, that kind of like spurred my learning and everything. But like, so like, that's what I don't want to do. I don't want to like entice people to buy like hype stocks. I just want people to understand there's good companies out there, and that if you buy for the long term and you buy good companies, defined, you know, very loosely as just like companies with economic moats, like they have some kind of business advantage, like you can do well with your money. And that doesn't mean you're doubling your money every year, right? And that's like a, I think, a trap like people got into after that that the whole COVID thing with stocks cratering, and then they just like that meteoric rise they had in 2020 and halfway through 2021. But you know, that doesn't mean, so it doesn't mean you're going to double your money, or you know, it's not like gambling where you can just get this huge payout right away. But if you want your money to grow and compound, and you understand compounding, like which blew my mind away. I remember like one night, like doing by hand, just if you grow your money by 8% a year and what that means in year 25, like I just couldn't believe, right? So like if you want, you know, if you think long term and you think like, hey, there's a way to do this. I ask, man, I'm going to get a little, I'm going to channel Jake Taylor a little here, if it's okay with like veggies. Yeah,
I got, you know, I love Jake.
Okay. I do too. Yeah. I love like your podcast Value After Hours. I mean, Toby's podcast Value After Hours. It's my favorite podcast, and I love your podcast too. You know that.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate you listening to both.
I listen to both every week.
I think I upset people with my universal story on the last one.
I say, oh, I'm a little behind.
So, yeah, well, you'll hear it on Monday. I raged a little bit.
All right.
Oh, well. I think a legitimate knock. I was with somebody who helped me skip some lines. Now, we paid for the fast pass for most of the lines. But on two of the lines, I not bended the truth. I mean, he lied his way into skipping the lines, and I went along with it. And I, you know, somebody got mad about the kids that got skipped, and I have sympathy for that argument. But if that's my biggest transgression in life, I think I've done a pretty decent job.
Right. That's okay.
Honestly, I mean, it was kind of thrilling. I've never skipped lines like that before. It brought me back to like being a 14-year-old sneaking into a movie or something. And I'm not like particularly proud about it, but I also don't really regret it either, if that makes sense.
Well, you know, you're you know, if you have a fault bill, it's like you're very transparent with your faults and with your, you know, your doubts. But that's what makes you so great to listen to.
I figure if somebody's not willing to forgive that transgression, me and them probably wouldn't get along anyway. And like I can let people know, like, I still feel internal guilt on that. So if, you know,
you're acknowledging it might not be the right thing to do.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But it's also not breaking a law.
But you did it. And it is like, you know, it is what it is.
That's right. And I might have been a little intoxicated while it happened. But you know what? It was a hell of a day. I had great friends. It was a great bond. And I was coming off of a super dad weekend. So I deserved it.
All right.
Anyway, I digress.
Okay.
Jake Taylor.
So I want to channel Jake Taylor here a little bit with if you do listen to Value After Hours, like, you know, he has these veggie segments that he calls them. And he always has like this really interesting anecdote from outside the investment world and then analogizes it to like make an investing lesson from it. But this is how I kind of think of it. So Pascal was this 17th century French philosopher and mathematician. And there's something called Pascal's wager, right? So if you're not familiar, like Pascal argued that a rational person, he was a Catholic, right? So he's like, a rational person should live as though God exists, and they should seek to believe in God. Because if God does not exist, okay, that person has like a very finite loss. So they lose out on some pleasures in life maybe, or some luxuries, et cetera. But if God does exist, that person has infinite gains, right? Because they're in heaven forever and they avoid like going to hell. So he's just like, so Pascal's wager was this argument that you should be a Christian because like what you stand to gain eternal life is better than what you stand to gain if
reasonable, you know, argument.
So that's Pascal's wager. So like I'll say like I don't have a good word for it, but it's the U.S. investors can make a similar wager, right? With the stakes not as high. So the stakes might not be quite as high.
You're not going to hell if you don't do it.
Right. But for 100+ years, like the U.S. stock market has been like the world's greatest wealth creation machine. And by investing, you're just making the wager that that's going to hold true for the next few decades. And if I'm right, by making that wager, like I win a secure and comfortable retirement. I can leave money to my kids. I can give to my favorite charities and causes. And so if I'm right, like all those things happen. And if I'm wrong, right? And things are so bad that the U.S. stock market tanks for good. Like, what are like the odds that in that scenario, my biggest concern is going to be my portfolio's returns.
Or you can hedge it and you can invest outside the U.S. You can place retirement bets, right?
Of course. 100%. Yeah. Just investing in general. Yeah. You probably shouldn't just use U.S. But like, what did I really lose out on? Like maybe like a few less pleasures along the way, you know, a less extravagant vacation here, you know, a less nicer car there, you know, so I lose out on a few things, but generally like, you know, I've been blessed. I can maintain a U.S. middle-class lifestyle. So I have all the comforts I really need and want in life. And so if I can invest and win all those possible things, and, you know, and if I'm wrong and the U.S. stock market tanks because of something really bad that happens, North Korea drops a bomb somewhere, or, you know, like another pandemic comes that makes COVID look like a cakewalk or whatever, like, you know, if really bad things happen in the world, like I'm probably not going to be too worried about my portfolio's returns. Like yeah. There's just other bigger fish to fry. So I believe it's rational for me to act as if the U.S. stock market will always rebound, even while understanding intellectually, like that actually might not happen. And like, because there are bad things that can happen that maybe like whatever has happened for the last 100-150 plus years might not continue on for the rest of my lifetime. But like, that's what I want like people to know. So like as a public figure, like going back all the way back to what you were saying, like,
yeah,
like that's what I want people to know. And I want them to get excited about investing. And so like, I'll even say this, like, and look, if you subscribe to 7Investing, like our job, like we want to provide you better returns than the S&P 500. And I believe over the long term, we're going to do that. I will say, in all honesty, we started in March 2020.
Yeah, not the best right, launch. Well, right, good launch. Tough 12 months.
So it was a great first year. The first year, yeah, we looked like geniuses. Like I even wrote a piece saying we're not this good, like basically because we were beating the market by so much. And right now we're not beating the market, but I believe long term we will. You know, and that is my job. But even if a person invests and, you know, they put some money in the S&P 500 and then they invest other money elsewhere into stocks because that's what gets them excited. And it gets them excited about investing. And they don't end up beating the S&P 500 with their other money. But by investing, I still think you're going to grow and compound your money unless, you know, like bad things happen. But if I can get people to do that, then that's great. That's like what I want people to know. Like you can invest your money in this.
And dude, you could get people into investing and they could decide, okay, well, you know, read some value books, right? Read some commodity investors, like read a bunch of different things and figure out how you want to place your chips and then place your chips. But at least if something happens, you're in control. And I think there's a lot of merit to turning it over to computers and algorithms. I also think, you know, there's a lot of merit. Well, let's put it this way. I fear if something went horribly wrong and I had turned everything over to a computer and an algorithm because, you know, I was told that it was the rational thing to do. And, I ended up getting screwed because I gave up control over my own financial life. That would like really be one of those things that I'm not sure I could look myself in the mirror. So some of it's regret minimization, right? I think it's Peter Kaufman says a happy life is more or less what you achieve over your regret. So if you can reduce your regret to zero, your happiness can go infinite. And, you know, I think that's a pretty decent formula to, you know, keep, you know, within the boundary of what makes sense. Right. But I've always really appreciated talking to you because, well, for a number of reasons, but one of them is I know how passionate you are about what you do. Two, you've always been one of the people that has come from the fool that I have, we often have valuation discussions. Like often, right? And sometimes things make you uncomfortable and you're like, but I don't know what to do with that because I know that it's expensive, but also this is a great business that I want to own for the long term. And you're somebody that that I have always found like lives what you say you do. And to me, that's probably the most important thing, right? I find you to be a high integrity individual doing things for the right reasons. So, you know, I'm very grateful that you said yes to coming on the show. I'm grateful that we chat off the show. And, you know, I look forward to staying your friend for a while until both of us leave this earth.
No, likewise, Bill. And yeah, I always enjoy, always enjoy talking to you. Always enjoy listening to you too. I almost feel like I know you better than I do because I listen to you so much, you know, through your podcast and everything. But no, I always enjoy chatting, and you know, it's if you're in the market now, you know, it's not the most fun time. But like again, I think it's rational to act as if like the market's going to rebound. It probably will. You know, for the last 100 years, it has, and yeah.
Well, look, I mean, I was getting destroyed in like November of 2021, and nothing else was getting touched. And I remember, you know, what was funny about it is all the value stocks that I owned were the ones that were getting crushed, right? And I was just like, what is going on here? Like, I'm the one that's just taking on water. And what I have found recently is the portion of my portfolio that is identified as value has been trading pretty strongly. I think that you can find some smaller SaaS companies, or, you know, some of the names in the carnage that are starting to trade reasonably strongly. And I think the generals get shot last. And I don't know. I mean, I'm going to channel my inner Jake Taylor and just say to people that, you know, are starting in investing or are sort of like you and I and trying to figure it out. I mean, I would turn off the stock market and I would go pick up the financials of the companies that you're looking at, write them out, and look at what you own and figure out if you want to own those things. And I would not look to the market for signal, because I think there's a lot of really, really sharp sharks out there that move things around that people like yourself or myself don't need to play that same game. And that doesn't necessarily make us the dumb money either.
Right. Like, so, and like real quick, like Morgan Housel once wrote this piece. He wrote it, I think, in 2015. And he was talking about the best performing stock of the last 20 years. So from 1995 to 2015.
Monster?
It is Monster. Very good. Very good. And it was up in that time, like 105,000%. So you had owned this stock. I mean, like, wow. I mean, that's like $10,000 into $10 million or $1,000 into $1 million. I mean, that's just like the once in a lifetime. It obviously not too many people held it that 20 years, but I'm just saying like that, that's that like, wow, that's just like that perfect like home run. And all he goes, the name of the article was called The Agony of High Returns. And you can Google it. Just that if you Google The Agony of High Returns, Morgan Housel, you'll see this article. And it was something like during that time when Munster returned 105,000%, it traded below its previous all-time high on 95% of the trading days during that period. And on average, it was down more than 25% below its high of the previous 2 years. It's had four drops of 50% or more. It lost more than two-thirds of its value twice and more than three-quarters once.
Morgan's awesome. And, what a good article.
And that was the best stock to own over a 20-year period. So if that's the best, the very best stock to own over a 20-year period, and it traded like that, you have to understand, like, when you just have a good stock, like, right? Like, there's going to be times, like, you will not be trading at all-time highs, and it will be down, and it's going to suffer losses, and you're going to be down a lot. Like, you know, again, on average, it was down, I think it was like 25, 26% of its front below its high of the previous 2 years. So you're just, it could feel psychologically like you're down all the time on that name. And if you were dollar cost averaging into it, you know, like you would, it could be like painful. And yet that was the very best stock to own for 20 years.
Yeah.
And
no, I love it, man. I think that's a fantastic lesson. I find, you know, I mean, now here come the Fang stinks tweets and this and that. And, you know, I think, I mean, look, Facebook, that's a different situation, but I find it interesting that, you know, I pulled up a 5-year chart of Berkshire today, right? Berkshire's returned 70% over 5 years, 13% a year, pretty freaking good, right? It has required Buffett to make the best investment of all time, I think. And Toby's the one that said it first. I don't know about first in the world, but I think he's right. Best investment of all time in Apple. And I'm curious, the people that, I'll just personalize this. I own Berkshire. Buffett bailed me out from by holding Apple. But if there's cognitive dissonance to say Fang is, you know, performing badly and I own Berkshire and, Fang's overvalued or something, like Apple is a big percentage of Berkshire at this point. And I just think, rather than getting caught up in sort of what's going on today and what stock's moving around, and same thing was with 2021. I mean, you know, that was euphoria. And I don't think this is not people say, like, well, you don't bottom on like, you know, you need like depression to bottom. I'm not sure. I mean, I know historically that's true, and it may be true again. We may get some huge puke. I don't think we're depressed, right? It's just not a very fun time. I would say the tide is going out. I don't know that we're at low tide.
Right.
But
you don't have to get the low tide, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, I don't know, right? Some market historian's going to laugh at this and say, no, you got to puke to bottom. I mean, maybe, but a lot of things got shellacked. The average does not tell the story.
And as an investor, like what I meant to say, like, you don't have to buy the exact bottom.
Yeah.
To do well. So, you know, man, I tweeted this out during COVID, like when everything just puked in March or April of 2020. But like, you know, if you look at when stocks hit their all-time high in 2007, late 2007, it didn't make that back for like 5 years, like 2012. And I forget the average amount it was down during that time, but it was like 20%. And yes, the bottom, you know, there's a bottom in November 2008 and like March 2009. And like those were, if you had bought those bottoms, like you did great. But you didn't have to buy those bottoms to do very, very well if you bought at any point in that like 5-year period.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, just if you're an individual investor, like don't beat yourself up if you don't buy the exact bottom. Like if you buy it and it goes down more, that's okay. You're not going to buy the bottom. You know, you're not going to buy the exact bottom, or at least in my experience, like I don't buy the exact bottoms.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody does. And you know, the other thing that's kind of funny is, some of the conversations that I have privately, you know, I like Microsoft is a good example, right? I was fortunate enough to be gifted, it's a concentrated position for me now. It's run up. And I say to people, well, would you sell it? And they're like, oh, I don't know that I'd sell it. Like, you got to pay tax and then you may never get it back at this price. And like, that sounds kind of nuts. Meanwhile, you know, publicly, they're like, oh, Microsoft's crazy overvalued, right? It's like, okay, well, which way do you want to have it?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the longer I do this, the more I realize the questions are very, very difficult to answer. And that's part of what makes it fun, man. If they were easy, it'd be boring.
It can be a very intoxicating and fun game, yeah. You know, and try to find fun in it if you're investing. And if you can't find fun in it, then just put your money in S&P 500. That's okay. You'll do okay with that. But if you find it fun, you know, it can be a very fun game, even if frustrating at times.
Let's say that people found this conversation fun. Where could they find you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter. I'm there way too much. Like I could just, me I just too, told man. You me like too. How much like, yeah, there's too much noise on Twitter and, you know, it's probably not good for you. And yet, like, I'm there way too much, at Matt_Cochran7, or you can check out our service at 7investing.com.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for joining, man. You're one of the good ones, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
It was a lot of fun, Bill. Thanks for having me.